2 Samuel chapter 5 presents us with an opportunity for several interesting detours, and we're going to take some of them. Now, on the surface, this chapter just seems to be simple, pretty straightforward, but in actuality, it's full of all kinds of twists and turns. It's just brimming with information, a lot of mystery that as Bible students, we need to examine it. And in some cases, it speaks of things that were common knowledge to the people of that day. But for us, in our time, our modern times, it takes some explanation. So I think you ought to expect the unexpected as we spend more time in this chapter than you might have thought it would need. I think you're going to find it interesting and pretty useful. Ish-bosheth, king of the northern group of the Israelite tribes, this is King Saul's former kingdom, and he was King Saul's son, is now dead at the hands of assassins who brought Ish-bosheth's head to David in hopes that they would get a reward for this. And 2 Samuel chapter 4 now sets the historical stage for David becoming the first king of Israel to rule over a united nation of all the Israelite tribes. Now, the use of the name or the term Israel is complex, and its meaning and its intent changes as we work our way through the Bible. So here we'll take our first detour, and we're going to use it to explain the term Israel. Now, Israel is at the center of all Bible stories since late in Genesis. And Israel is at the heart of all Bible prophecies fulfilled, or those that are still future to us. So it's vital we understand the various applications of the term. And the first thing to know is that the term Israel is highly anachronistic. That is, you have to know the precise era and the setting to understand what Israel meant at any given time, because it changed, it evolved. And the first use of the term Israel was merely as a new name or perhaps a title for that great patriarch Jacob, Yaakov. And since that title was given to Jacob by Jehovah, then obviously it carries some weight. So to be clear, the original use of the word Israel applied to just a single individual, one person. Only after Jacob had a number of sons, and then his clan grew in number, and influence grew along with it, did Israel come to denote Jacob's descendants as a people group, a named people group. And then centuries after Jacob's death, Joshua led this people group called Israel into the promised land, but immediately they fractured into tribal alliances, and their common ancestral heritage became a matter of secondary importance to them. Some of the people group called Israel decided not to enter into the promised land, and instead they settled on the eastern bank of the Jordan River. That group, the one that didn't cross the river, the one that didn't enter into the promised land, divided itself into two coalitions. So did the one that crossed the river. It divided itself into two coalitions. Now, since the northern coalition held itself up as the majority and said that they represented 10 of the 12 Israelite tribes, which, by the way, is an exaggeration, they claimed the right to consider themselves Israel. The southern coalition that consisted mainly of Judah and Simeon, but was always totally dominated by Judah, was considered a breakaway group. They were seen as a separate entity, apart from Israel. They even went by the name Judah. So when David first became a king, he was only king over the modest size entity that was called Judah, down here to the south. He wasn't king of Israel, at least not in the eyes of the 12 tribes. And when Saul was king, he tried to be king over all the tribes, but only those of the northern coalition accepted him as king. Judah condescended to King Saul's administration to some degree, but only so far as to gain whatever benefit they could from the relationship and to prevent a direct confrontation with their brothers up north. But the tension between Israel and Judah was palpable, and it spilled over from time to time into armed conflict. The people of Judah and Simeon certainly acknowledged that they shared a common ancestor with the northern tribes, Jacob. But at that time, the reality of a common heritage took a back seat to all of the man-made political realities. So as we approach now 2 Samuel chapter 5, keep in mind that by the northern coalition of tribes agreeing now to accept David as their king, it was not unlike a new state being added to the USA. Judah and Israel were separate entities, and what was about to happen was that they would join together as a single entity under one king, David. And since this traditional separateness was centuries old, it was quite a traumatic event when the North and the South, these two tribal coalitions, became joined together. And as you can imagine, not all the clans and families agreed with this. Benjamin, most of all, hated this idea. After all, the first two kings of Israel were Benjamites. And with that came a lot of prestige and benefit. You know, it's one thing to turn the kingship over to one of the other members of the Northern Tribal Coalition. It's quite another to voluntarily give yourself over to the rule of that Southern Tribal Coalition, Judah. So beginning with chapter 5, it can quickly get confusing as to when the term Israel is referring only to the northern tribes versus when it means all the tribes of Israel as this newly unified group under David. And then there is the issue that in one context, Israel is the people of the 12 tribes, and in another context, Israel is the land of the 12 tribes. Now I'm going to try to point out which of these is which as we move along. So, open your Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 5, page 339 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. 2 Samuel chapter 5. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "Here, we are your own flesh and bone. In the past, when Saul was king over us, it was you who led Israel's military campaigns, and Adonai said to you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel, you will be chief over Israel.' So all the leaders of Israel came to the king in Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them in Hebron in the presence of Adonai. They then anointed King David king over Israel, and David was 30 years old when he began his rule, and he ruled for 40 years. And in Hebron, he ruled over Judah 7 years and 6 months. Then in Jerusalem, he ruled 33 years over Israel and Judah. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem to attack the Jebusites, the inhabitants of that region. And they taunted David, 'You're not going to get in here. Even the blind and the lame could fend you off.' In other words, they were thinking, David will never get in here. Nevertheless, David captured the stronghold of Zion, also known now as the city of David. And what David said on that day was, in order to attack the Jebusites, you have to climb up from the spring outside the city through the water tunnel. Then you can do away with those so-called lame and blind, whom David despises, hence the expression, the blind and the lame keep him from entering the house. David lived in the stronghold, and he called it the city of David. And then David built up the city around it, starting at the Milo and working inward. And David grew greater and greater because Adonai, the God of armies, was with him. Hiram, king of Zor, sent envoys to David with cedar logs, and with them were carpenters and stonemasons, and they built David a palace. David then knew that Adonai had set him up as king over Israel and increased his royal power for the sake of his people. David took for himself more concubines and wives in Jerusalem after coming from Hebron, so that still more sons and daughters were born to David. And here are the names of those born to him in Jerusalem. Shamwa, Shabav, Natan, Shlomo, Yivkar, Elshua, Nefeg, Yafya, Elshma, Elyada, and Eliphelet. And when the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, all the Philistines went up in search of David. And on learning of it, David went down to the stronghold. The Philistines came and deployed in the Rephaim Valley. And David consulted Adonai, asking, should I attack the Philistines? Will you hand them over to me? And Adonai answered David, attack. I will certainly hand the Philistines over to you. So David went to Baal Pratzim and defeated them there. And he said, Adonai has broken through my enemies for me, like a river breaking through its banks. This is why he called the place Baal Pratzim, Lord of Breaking Through. The Philistines had left their idols there, so David and his men took them away. The Philistines came up and deployed in the Rephaim Valley. And when David consulted Adonai, he said, don't attack, circle behind them, engage them opposite the balsam trees. And when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, advance, because then Adonai has gone out ahead of you to defeat the army of the Philistines. David did exactly as Adonai had ordered him to do. He pursued his attack on the Philistines from Geba all the way to Gezer. Hebron is the unofficial capital city of Judah. This city had a heritage that could be traced all the way back to Father Abraham. David chose to move from Ziklag, which was in Philistine territory, to Hebron because it was so thoroughly understood in the region that Hebron was the most prominent city of the entity called Judah. This brought him a couple of things. First, it placed him in the power center of Judah, which is, of course, where the prospective leader of Judah was obligated to reside. And second, Judah, and therefore Hebron, was not seen by the Philistines as their enemy, as was Israel up to the north. King Saul fought against the Philistines as the king of Israel. And when Saul died, Ish-bosheth became the new king of Israel, and so he was instantly an enemy of the Philistines. David first became king over Judah, not over Israel. And so while this may have rankled the Philistines a little bit, Judah wasn't the Philistines' enemy at this time. And so they remained on relatively peaceful terms with David's administration. But all that was about to change. Verse 1 has an entourage of elders from the northern tribal coalition, the Israel, formerly governed by Saul, then his son Ishbosheth. And they're coming to Hebron to finalize a joining together, perhaps a better way, a rejoining of Israel with Judah. And when they address David, they stated four reasons why they see this rejoining of all the tribes as the right thing to do. First, David was already a king. And even though he was only king over Judah, he had established himself as royalty. He was accepted as a legitimate monarch. And for the northern coalition, then there was no shame in placing themselves under an existing king. And second, the northern leaders pointed out that they were related by blood to David. We're your own flesh and bone, they say. Their common connection to Jacob hadn't really mattered all that much over the last few centuries, and it was only used when it was convenient, was now invoked as a good and proper reason for them to give their allegiance to David and for David to treat them well, to treat them not as vassals, but as brethren, which they were. And third, it tells us in verse 2, they always saw David as the real leader of Israel, King Saul's northern coalition, because David had led so many of Saul's successful military campaigns. And fourth, they acknowledge that Jehovah had decreed that David was to be king over all Israel, here meaning all 12 tribes. So we again run into a statement that God had anointed David as king over all Israel, and while we find no surviving Bible narrative of that kind of a public statement by God or by a prophet of God, there was no doubt some recorded and commonly known divine oracle to that effect that apparently has been lost to history. So the elders of the north saw David as their natural brother and as a proven and demonstrated leader of the northern tribal armies in times past, so they were comfortable with placing themselves under his monarchy, under his leadership. They made a covenant with David. There was an anointing ceremony. And I want to stress yet again that for us in hindsight, we easily view the 12 tribes of Israel as a unity, and therefore as natural brethren, because all the tribes came from the loins of Jacob. But in that era, what we're witnessing here in the north, anointing David as their king, would be akin to the USA announcing, or rather renouncing, our sovereignty that we had earned in war against King George of England, and then agreeing to voluntarily rejoin ourselves to England under their governance. That's how serious a matter this is. And while we might be able to rationalize such a thing by saying that historically we were at one time literally connected to England through common ancestors, to do such a thing would be terribly radical, and probably it wouldn't be very popular. Also recognize that approximately the same amount of time has passed since the USA gained its independence from England until today as when Judah and Israel split apart from one another until David's time. So a lot of time had passed. The two kingdoms warred against one another. Their separateness was well established. No one had ever known of a time or had experienced a time, no one alive had, when Judah and Israel were considered as one family or one nation. This would be a brand new experience. So generations came and went with people who identified themselves either to Israel or to Judah. Any sense of kinship between Judah and Israel would have been very distant in David's day. So this is a good context to hang on to as we go forward, because it helps us to understand many of the actions that we'll see unfold in these coming chapters. So verse 4 states that David was 30 years old when he began to rule, and that he ruled for 40 years. Now, first of all, understand these are round numbers that are also idealized numbers. 30 was seen as the prime of life, when mental and physical capabilities are at their greatest and when sufficient wisdom has been gained to properly utilize all those capabilities. The age of 30 was eventually adopted as the earliest age allowable for a Hebrew to become a rabbi. It's no coincidence that Yeshua is said to have begun his ministry at what age? 30. That David ruled for 40 years is also an approximate, and it's an idealized number. In fact, the very next verse says he ruled over Judah for 7.5 years and then ruled from Jerusalem as king over all Israel for 33 more years. A little quick math adds up those two numbers to 40.5 years, not 40 years. So the number 40, you see, is often indicative of a generation. And a generation is often meant to be seen more as an era than how we tend to think of a generation as being the way we divide families into the generation of the parents, the generations of the children, the grandchildren, and so on. 40 is also thought of as a fullness of time, a proper amount of time, whether it's expressed in days, months, or years, for testing. 40 is the number of trials. So the bottom line is that neither David's quoted age of 30 nor the quoted years of his reign of 40 are meant to be precise. No doubt they're very close. They could be off by a few months, maybe a year or so, according to the way we would use a calendar today. Those two round numbers carry a much greater significance in their spiritual meaning than just historically appropriate data. Now, notice something else about David becoming a king. It was a long process. It took place on a bumpy and winding road, and I think we should see this process as a pattern that was fulfilled in Messiah Yeshua. Jesus was designated by the Father as the king, prince really, the Nagi, the king in waiting, long before it ever became a reality. Yehovah ordained David as king over his people long before the actual earthly event caught up to the spiritual reality of it. So we had many things that had to be accomplished along the way. A lot had to align in order for David to gain the throne of Israel. The same thing is happening for Messiah. In fact, the earthly reality of Yeshua's kingship is still in our future, even though it was predicted by the prophets more than 2,500 years ago, and it happened to a largely spiritual extent 2,000 years ago. Christ became king over God's king, becoming king over God's kingdom is a long process. A lot's got to happen along the way, far more than it just being some single event in time. Now, verse 6 briefly tells us the story of a critical event that affects the entire world. In fact, it is probably more important today than it was when it first happened. Verse 6 begins the story of the establishment of Jerusalem, as the capital of David's and thus God's kingdom. The first part of this verse explains that the king and his men went to Jerusalem to attack it. These men were David's private army. These were not the tribal or national army. So it wasn't a huge contingent of men that were taken, but they were loyal, they were well-trained, and these were experienced warriors. This fact's going to play an important role that we're going to get to very shortly. And in order to understand what's going on, we need to understand the nature of Jerusalem in this era, as well as its past. So we're going to make another one of those detours. to see what we can find out about this wonderful city. Modern archaeology, along with the discovery and translation of some ancient clay tablets, has helped to piece together the astounding history of this place. If we were to pin a date on a calendar for David's attack on Jerusalem, it would probably be about 990 BC, give or take a couple of years. But this city was known, its existence was recorded long before that. Jerusalem is one of the most ancient cities in the world. It is mentioned by name in the famous Ebla archives. These Ebla archives consist of some 15,000 clay tablets that were uncovered starting in the late 1960s in northern Syria. And written in the Akkadian language, these tablets tell of the reign of King Ibit-Ilim, the ruler of a place called Ebla, that lay only 150 miles from Haran, which is the place where Abraham lived for a time. And the tablets have been dated to 2500 BC. And found in them is the record of a Canaanite city that we know now is Jerusalem, along with a description of exactly where it was located. There's no doubt it's the same place that we call Jerusalem today. Now, how much before 2500 BC Jerusalem existed, called by at least two other names, is debatable. The point is that that city existed at least 500 years before the time of Abraham, and 1500 years before David set about to conquer it. Now, Akkadian is probably rightly considered the mother language of Hebrew. It's a cousin of Aramaic. And in scholarly terms, Akkadian is the cognate language of Hebrew, and so as more and more has recently been discovered and understood about the Akkadian language, we've learned more and more about the meanings of some of the earliest known Hebrew words as we find them in the earliest parts of the Torah. And there's always been a debate about even the precise meaning of the term Yerushalayim. But the reality turns out it's an Akkadian word. It wasn't a Hebrew word. Now that this fact has been recognized, you see, it's clear that it means something like the foundation of Shalem. It's also clear that Shalem was the name, or better, the title of a god. So perhaps a better way to say it is it's the foundation of the god Shalem. Think about that for a minute. I think that word Shalem sounds familiar to you, because the word Shalom comes from it. So the idea is that the god of this city of 2500 BC was a god whose chief attribute was Shalom. Now, I wonder who that can be. Turn your Bibles to the book of Genesis, chapter 14. Book of Genesis, chapter 14. You have a complete Jewish Bible. We're going to start on page 13, and we're going to read from Genesis 14, verse 14 through 20. So 14 through 20. When Avram, Abraham, heard that his nephew had been taken, he led out his trained men who had been born in his house, 318 of them, and he went in pursuit as far as Dan. And during the night, he and his servants divided his forces against them, and then attacked and pursued them all the way to Hovah, north of Damascus, that's Damascus. And he recovered all the goods and brought back his nephew Lot with his goods, together with all the women and the other people. And after his return from slaughtering Kedor Lomer and the kings with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him in the Shave Valley, also known as the King's Valley. Melchizedek, king of Shalem. brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of El Elyon, the God Most High. So he blessed him with these words. Blessed be Abraham by El Elyon, maker of heaven and earth. Blessed be El Elyon, who handed your enemies over to you. Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. Here we find the story of the mysterious Melchizedek, king and priest of the city of Shalem. Yes, that city, Shalem, the same Shalem as in the Ebla archives documents. And we know from the narrative that Melchizedek worshiped the one true creator God that he also called El Elyon, the Most High God. And there's little doubt that the language Abraham spoke at this time was Akkadian. He was an Amorite who was recently arrived from Mesopotamia, and certainly it's also Akkadian that Melchizedek spoke. Hebrew wasn't yet its own language. Akkadian is a Semitic language. Let me remind you that the term Semitic is essentially a mispronunciation. It ought to be pronounced Shemitic. Semite means from the line of Shem. Shem was one of Noah's three sons. So Akkadian is a language that is traced back towards Shem. And Abraham and Melchizedek both speak some form of it. And we know from ancient non-biblical records that the city of Shalem existed at least 500 years before Abraham. It all fits together perfectly. The most ancient Hebrew tradition on the subject insists unequivocally that Melchizedek was none other than the now very aged Shem, Noah's son. Why didn't they just call Melchizedek Shem then and get it over with? Because Melchizedek isn't a name. It's a title. It means the king of righteousness. So while Shem is a formal name, like Yeshua is a formal name, Melchizedek is a title. Or it's an attribute, just like Messiah is a title. It's an attribute. It's not a name. And biblical genealogical records make it clear Shem was still living when Abraham was alive. And while proof is much too big of a word for use in this situation, the circumstantial evidence just keeps getting greater that indeed Shem was probably the king and priest of the God Most High, that he lived in the city of Shalem, that he held the title of the Melchizedek, and that this is who Abraham met at the city of Shalem called Yerushalayim in Akkadian. Now, another name that we find in the Bible for this same place is Jebus or Yevus. And the name of the inhabitants of this place, as we read in David getting ready to attack it, is the Yevusi, or in English, Jebusites. Judges 19:10 says this. But the man wouldn't stay that night, so he got up and left with his concubine, and he saddled two donkeys, and they arrived at Jebus, also known as Yerushalayim. So we have proof of it. We don't have to guess. So we know without doubt now that Jebus and Yerushalayim are the same place, just spoken in two different languages under two different circumstances. And since many places and locations in the Bible have existed for hundreds and thousands of years, their place names have changed, and or they're called by a number of different names at the same time, and very normally, the different names are really just the same name in different languages. That's all it is. Las Vegas is at times called Sin City, or just Vegas for short. Los Angeles is at times called the City of Angels, or just L.A. A long time ago, it was literally called the place of 10,000 smokes. Before that, it was the Chumash Indians. See, before modern times, it was the Chumash Indians who lived there. And there were so many hundreds of thousands of them that they saw all these campfires and the smoke going up, and that's where it got the name, 10,000 smokes from campfires. So laymen and scholars have had a hard time trying to understand what the many words for this place, Jerusalem, have meant over the ages. So far, we've seen this place called Yerushalayim, Jebus, and the city of Shalem. Three names now for the same place. The story of the taking of Yerushalayim by David now adds the terms, the stronghold, the city of David, the Milo, and Zion. So which is which? What's what in all these names? Let's see if we can straighten some of that out, because I think it's going to result in your general Bible reading being more meaningful at times, and we're going to also lend some needed help when you're trying to understand prophecies. Now, ancient cities don't generally begin as walled cities. They usually begin as small villages, and then for some important reason or another, the settlement becomes seen as more valuable than usual. So an enemy covets it, and then it's walled for protection against that enemy. And building a wall around a city is a formidable undertaking. It took a strong and a powerful leader to order it, to organize it, to see it through. And then it, of course, took a substantial population to provide all the manpower and material to construct it. The original Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, before it was a walled city, would have been a village with farmers and herders with their fields and their pastures surrounding it. Further, these ancient villages and cities didn't have precise boundaries. You didn't come up to a sign that says, "You're entering Jerusalem. Have a nice day." Today, we measure the boundaries of everything from residential lots, right down to the millimeter, right up to the boundaries of nations, down to the millimeter. But in ancient times, the boundaries were pretty general and approximate. A valley, a hillside, a plain, up to a river, near a boulder, over by that tree. But once you wall off an area, oh, you've now defined a boundary. And in ancient times, when an ill-defined but named area had a walled city built upon part of it, usually that walled city part was given a separate name from the general area upon which it had been built. Or it was called the city of so-and-so, meaning that the city was built upon a land area of a certain name. Sometimes it would be named after a god or a king. Yerushalayim was the name for the village and the surrounding area where it was built. We don't know of another name going back any further than this. At some point, the place also became known as Jebus, because Jebus was the name of a tribe or a clan of Canaanites who had either inhabited the place, or maybe they were the ones that built it originally. In any case, it was these Jebusites, the people of Jebus, who inhabited the area in David's time and held that walled city. And one of the names assigned to the walled city portion of this place was Zion. A walled city is also a stronghold. It's a fallback place where one can defend against intruders. And the reason it is sometimes termed a stronghold is because the vast majority of the people living at that area lived outside the city walls. So You would have a walled city where the king and his family and the royal court and rich merchants and others with reason and status to have the privilege of living inside of those walls resided. Then the general and the larger population lived in buildings outside the walls. And these villagers gave their allegiance to that king of that city, that walled city, for the very reason that if danger from a marauder came, then the city gates would be open to allow these villagers to stream inside, then the doors would be shut, and this became their stronghold. So the general area was called Yerushalayim and Jebus, but the walled city portion of it was called Zion. When David captured it, he changed the name from Zion to the city of David. But as is obvious, the name Zion has been retained and has been applied for other purposes we're not going to get into tonight. Now, there's another reference in these passages to a place there called the Milo. And the term means an earthen mound or a rampart. Or in modern language, a terrace is probably apt. Now, this might be referring to a particular section of the city of David, a particular section, rather, of the city of David, or it could be what is today called the Ophel, that's located just outside of the ancient wall up at the northern end. Here's the city of David at the northern end up here. If one looks at a map of the ancient city of Jerusalem, what you will see is that the city of David is the oldest and original walled portion. And it's located well down the slope from Mount Moriah. Here you see the temple, which is on the highest part of the mountain, and it's all downhill. The city of David is bordered by canyons and ravines, including the Kidron Valley, that runs along here, which of course made it more difficult to attack because you had to climb up a hill. Then there's a substantial open place between the northern wall of the city of David and the Temple Mount area. In between those two places, it's called today at least the Ophel. And there, many villagers built their homes in order to expand the city on up the hill. So the idea was to eventually extend these walls on up the hill to encompass the Ophel and then eventually all the Temple Mount. Basically, this is what's being described in verse 9. Now, the reason that David attacked Jerusalem was to make it his capital. See, Hebron was the very symbol of the kingdom of Judah. So the northern tribal coalition was never going to accept Hebron as a capital for all Israel. In fact, I highly suspect that part of the covenant treaty that the elders from the north signed with David specifically demanded that a new capital city would be found that was more neutral in its location. Well, Yerushalayim was right on the border between Israel and Judah. It was claimed by neither entity. It wasn't even inhabited by Hebrews, so you can't get much more neutral than that. But there is another aspect that's invariably overlooked. So before we move on, let me explain something else that I have rarely, if ever, heard discussed. Over and over in the Bible, we'll just see the two terms Judah and Israel tied together, just as we'll often see the two terms Jerusalem and Judah tied together. And as you now know, the reason that Judah and Israel are tied together is not because they were two different names for the same place, but rather because indeed they were two separate entities. Only when tied together do they form all Israel. Separately, they just represent a part of Israel. So why are Judah and Jerusalem often spoke of in that same fashion. All the evidence and circumstances indicate that at the very least, that portion of Jerusalem called the City of David was held onto by David as his own private estate. Let me say that another way. The City of David belonged to David. It was his property. It was not national territory. This explains why it is that David used his private army instead of his national army to conquer Jebus. By doing so, this would be seen as more of a private endeavor rather than a national one. Had he used the tribal troops to conquer the walled city, the tribal leaders would certainly have expected for this to be seen as a joint expedition, and so the walled city they would see as national property to be shared among all the tribes. Now, don't let that confuse you, because in the United States, we have a similar situation. Washington, D.C. was chosen to be the capital of the United States precisely because it wasn't part of any state. And it remains so to this day. So Washington, D.C. is considered as a neutral site. And it's not affiliated with any coalition of states, making it the ideal place for our central federal government. The main difference between what David did and what happened here in America is that Washington, D.C. isn't privately owned. At least I don't think it is. Although I wonder sometimes. While it seems that the City of David was David's personal property. So one way to think about it is that while the City of David was located in Jerusalem, it was a privately held section of Jerusalem that was walled off, and it was owned by the king. So it was treated very differently than the rest of Jerusalem that lay outside those city walls. Now, that kind of philosophy seems to have embedded itself in the very essence of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel from David's day forward. That is, Jerusalem was in Israel, and it was the capital of Israel, but it's always seen as a somewhat separate entity. It's spoken of as a somewhat separate entity. Washington, D.C. is in America. It is the capital of America, but it is seen as a separate entity, apart from the Confederation of 50 states that forms America. Even in Yeshua's day, when the Holy Land was divided up into the Roman provinces of Idumea and Perea and Samaria and Galilee and Judea, Jerusalem was spoken of as a separate entity from all the rest of them. So we have numerous mentions in the New Testament of Judah or Judea and Jerusalem. Now, it's interesting how even today, many Jews and many Christians, for that matter, can accept the idea of Jerusalem being an international city that's located in the heart of Israel, but at the same time could be seen as a separate entity that is operated by some international body, such as the UN. Thus, it could perhaps be the capital of Israel and the capital of the Palestinian state simultaneously. In fact, that's more or less how Jerusalem was envisioned by the UN when the land was apportioned into Jewish and Arab states over six decades ago. Jerusalem was not to be owned by either the Arabs or the Jews. It was not to be Jewish territory. It was not to be Arab territory. It was to be a neutral site. It was to be a world heritage site for everybody to enjoy. Of course, many more Jews and Arabs rejected that idea than those who accepted it, but I think we'll see this international city concept arise again and again as the demand intensifies for Israel to return to its pre-1967 borders. And in case you might be thinking that there is a biblical backing based on David's actions for that idea, forget it. Jerusalem was the capital only of Israel. It wasn't an international city. David was the king. He owned only the city of David, not all of Jerusalem. So we must be clear that, correctly speaking, the city of David was not Israel's capital city, but Jerusalem was. The city of David was just David's private and secure, personally owned compound, which also explains why the temple was not built in the city of David, but rather in Jerusalem up the hill on Mount Moriah. And we're going to continue with another interesting and, I think, different unexplored aspect about David's taking of Jerusalem the next time we meet.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.